When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Welcome to Board Gamers Anonymous, the podcast about board gamers and the insane fun we have at the table together. This is Chris.
Hey, and this is Anthony.
And this is episode 477, the top 10 Reiner Knizia games. We'd like to thank all our Patreon backers for helping us bring you a brand new episode. Hey everyone, we're back and we are talking about the genius, the mathematician, the legend that is Reiner Knizia.
Yes, he of 750 whatever games.
At least.
Like, I remember when I got into the hobby, I was like, that seems made up. I was like, no, that is real. And back then it was like 400 something. Fast forward 12, 13 years, it's like, oh no, now it's 700, 800 something.
He knows the math, he does the math, and he puts together a very fine abstract.
Yeah. Yeah, these games are generally abstracted to some degree. That's what you get from a mathematician. but there are some very interesting games in here, too, that are not purely abstract exercises. Like, the math is there. You dig around, the math is
sure.
There. But it puts a little more time in. He could throw a good theme together as well. Although I did always wonder how that process works. Like, is it like when James Patterson writes a novel? Like, he's in his office, quote-unquote, writing, and somebody else is out in the hallway, like, actually typing?
Yeah.
Or is this man legit just working like 30 hours a day game after game?
Yeah. A lot of these designers, I think they're on a different level, and it's just, there's numbers and craftsmanship running through their heads at all hours. And at the end of the day, what makes a game good, I think objectively, is the math, right?
Right.
Does it, can you play it, right? Somebody has to do the math. Now, whether it's simple math or complex math or algorithms or anything else, I mean, it at the end of the day, it has to be the core of any game. Now, as you mentioned, theme and thematics are, can be challenging. And obviously production historically has been a challenge throughout. But now he's got some production value behind his games. A couple of Reed Deluxe that were out there, and his newest games are coming out with like higher production values. So I don't think there's anything stopping him at this point. So if he was not a, known name at home, I think certainly he will be now.
Right. Right. Yeah, definitely up there. And yeah, like you said, like a lot of these games getting reproduced, re-released, re-themed, whatever. And now there are these big, ridiculous, over, beautiful monstrosities of games that we're used to from Kickstarter and GameFound. Definitely gets it out there more. Yeah, because you got like 10,000 people buying a really fancy copy, and then all of a sudden we all want to play our fancy copy.
Yeah, I think that's the other side of it too, right? You don't want to see the math, right? You don't want to see behind the magician. You just want to enjoy the magic.
Yeah. Show me a pretty show. I don't really care how it happens. I just want to have fun.
Yeah. And I think when it becomes too abstracted and you can see the formulas and you can see the math and you're just like, I'm out of the game. So, yeah, these games are in the games, and these are our top 10 games of Ryan and Kenizia of all time. So that's going to be a fun, cool list, because it's what all the cool kids doing in Disney's, man. It's all about the top 10s.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, top 10 everything. Top 10, top 10s. That's the next one, man. Top 10, top 10s.
Top 10, 10 times? Okay. Cool, 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 cool. All right. All right. With that said, Anthony, what's going on with our friends out there? What's our question of the week?
All right. Question of the week this week is, what is the most challenging aspect of the board gaming hobby? So, you know, we all complain about a lot of things.
No, not us.
Yeah. Board gamers. Come on. Never.
Nah, get out of here.
We're so magnanimous.
That doesn't happen.
Yeah, no, it does. It does.
It does?
Yeah. So I figured, hey, like, what are those things? What are we all collectively complaining about? And over on the Patreon, we had a lot of good answers here. Drew says time, okay. Our most precious resource, shows its scarcity in our hobby as well. Our number one frustration when a game does not play well, it was a waste of time. Time researching the game, time learning the game, time playing the game. This time is the answer.
Time after time?
Time after time, it's time.
Okay.
Tim says coordinating schedules with friends, usually possible with some effort, but not frequent enough to keep up with all the new games we've acquired. Ryan says definitely finding players. I'm fortunate that I have a very small group of friends I can occasionally play with, but I'd love to play more often, especially games I like that my group didn't particularly like. I think I agree with all of those. Time for sure. I like always run out of time trying to play a game, learn a game, whatever. And then coordinating schedules or finding people to play with. That last one in particular for me, just as a busy middle-aged parent, like, okay, I'm free at this time for an hour and a half, but not the same time next week. It's going to be a different day.
Sure.
Does that work for hello? Anybody? No, okay. All right. I'll find someone else. So yeah, those definitely all resonate with me a lot. Over on the Facebook page, we have David mentioning time, as well as Matt also mentioning time to play. Lucy mentions time and ability to concentrate fully for a few hours.
Oh, there you go.
So that last one I think is very interesting as well. I think a lot of people and there's different factors that come into that, right? You have like distractions, you have exhaustion. I used to play games with my wife when our kids were a little bit younger, when they went to bed earlier. if a kid goes to bed at 6:30 or 7, then we can get a game in before everybody gets too tired. Now it just never happens because the kids are in bed around 9:30, and then it's got like an hour left at best. So definitely feel that. And Michael mentions playing games with a max 4-player count. Group is typically 5 to 6 players, and I don't want to exclude anyone. So most games are 1 to 4 players, and that does become a problem if you always have 5 to 6. So lots of good answers. I think time is the big one for a lot of people. I see a few in here for budget. Our buddy David mentions budget to get all the games I want and money to go to big conventions. Yes, same, Dave. Same. lots of issues out there. What about you, man?
I think weirdly the thing that's been popping up now, time makes the most sense. Money certainly too, of course. But if you have a couple of nickels you can rub together and get a game, like if you only have 1 or 2 games in your collection, you're still good to go.
Right.
Obviously, that's harder to do these days because now with all the super deluxifications, you need more than just a couple of nickels to rub together. Space. Space has been very hard to come by. Some of that is because post-COVID, post-lockdown, post-economic distress, a lot of those local friendly game stores have closed. And a lot of those third spaces, which I think is a bigger epidemic, societal epidemic across the board, we're not finding anymore.
Right.
Where do you go to hang out where you're not being asked to like buy more stuff?
Yeah, I can rant about this all day because every time I find a new game group in Philadelphia, it's at a bar.
Yeah.
They're all at bars. I'm like, I don't want to hang out at a bar at the end of the day. I'm just like, I don't. It's dark. It's dank. It's expensive. I don't really want to drink. Like, can we meet anywhere else? And there is nowhere else. So that's why people end up in bars. There's a lot of bars. So, yeah, that's a big frustration. Yeah.
And again, it's difficult because, like you said, time is a challenge, but if you don't have a place, then time doesn't matter, right? Like, I just started going to a game group that they meet at a library on Saturdays, but only in these hours and only on these particular situations. And I'm just like, ah. And then, like you said, sometimes it's the bar, sometimes it's a restaurant, which is also hard to navigate. Sometimes it's a food store if they have outside tables, also hard to navigate. And then obviously not everyone has their own space at home to kind of accommodate everybody in that space without disrupting literally everything that's happening there. So space, surprisingly enough, has been the thing that's been even more problematic than I think time and money combined these days.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear that.
All right. Well, that's everything that's going on with us out there, and especially with everyone out there. Please find the time, space, and money if you can, so you can get some more of these great games together. All right, Anthony, so that's everything everyone's talking about. Let's talk about things we love to talk about. Let's talk about our acquisition disorders.
All right. So for me, I got one that's been up on the hotness now for a week or two. Ironwood is a new game from Mindclash Games. And Mindclash has made the migration over to GameFound as well. So, like, buy Kickstarter. we knew they will.
Although I will say, just really quick, Kickstarter came out recently and said that they're going to do like a complete redesign of Kickstarter, including late pledges and basically, I guess, all the feedback of stuff that they haven't been doing.
Yeah.
So that's a thing.
It makes sense when like your largest category by orders of magnitude is like leaving you by orders of magnitude.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, no, your website's not great. We're going to go over here. I guess we'll change our website.
All right.
All right. So anyways, this is a new Mindclash game, and it is a 1-2 player dueling game that's only an hour long. So it's great. I love that Mindclash is getting into these smaller, more accessible games, because I love Voidfall. It was my game of the year last year. I love Anachrony. I love Tricarion. These are all great, amazing, big, long, epic opus Euros. But I also like the really weird, quirky approach that Mindclash has, and would love it for it to be an hour or two. So we had Septima last year. We got this one here, Ironwood, now this year. And it looks really fascinating. So it is a asymmetrical dueling game, card driven, where you are either the Ironclad, which, as you imagine, means you're wearing a bunch of armor. You are with the people in the buildings, so the governments or whatever. often the evil empire, but in this case it's kind of unclear. Or you are the woodwalkers, so those who are more in tune with nature, and you're using cards and kind of it's your basic tactical dueling game, right? There's a bunch of them that are out there, but this one is seems to be tight and focused and built around this board, and it's a fascinating looking combination of just like great looking artwork, and an almost root-like aesthetic, but that's not even the right way to put it. It's in the woods, and the map looks very root-like, but it's a 1v1 tactical combat game, right? So it's got the asymmetry, and it's got the woods, but otherwise it's got a lot of other things going on. So I'm all about it. I love me some asymmetrical two-player games. I think 3 or 4 of my top 10 games of all time are asymmetrical two-player games, between War of the Ring and Star Wars Rebellion and Watergate. So this is a great one that I will keep an eye on, that I hope is good as well. So it's on GameFound now. You can check it out there. It is designed by a couple of relatively new designers, Mael Brunet and Julian Chaput, but it is Mindclash Games. So of course it has a solo mode made by David Turchi. which I'm fascinated by on its own. Like, what is the solo mode for a two-player dueling game?
Yeah, like it's going to be an AI, right?
Probably. Yeah. I don't know what else it would be. Like, people have made solo modes for War of the Ring and Star Wars Rebellion. I don't enjoy them really because they're very cumbersome.
It's a bot. it's
a bot, and there's a lot of things to move around. So, if it's that, but I do like the two-player approach regardless. So, I'll be checking this one out. It looks interesting. And it's inexpensive because it's a simple, smaller game. It's 50 euros, not the 120 that we're used to seeing. So Ironwood. It's up on GameFound now for, what is it, 2 more weeks when we're recording. So at least another week when you hear this. And yeah, it's cool looking. That's all I got. It's cool looking, but it's got the pedigree behind it. It's got the mechanics that I'm looking for.
Mindclash is doing everything now. Like, they're always kind of known for just doing very inventive, different types of games, more than any other publisher that I know. Mm-hmm. This is yet another page in their book, so to speak. I kind of, honestly, I kind of dismissed this at first look for two reasons. One, it looked like almost every other two-player game. Mm-hmm. You know, like, the box looks like standard everything. I want to name one or two or three games, but it looks like Mage Wars. It looks like everything. It looks like the same thing. I was surprised to see the board here, and I was surprised to see the asymmetry here, which is great. Two-player games are generally hard to get to the table. You know, it's a different game style, like if you have a partner or, you know, a friend that you're just constantly playing with, but otherwise a game night's a little more difficult. I don't know. Are you backing this?
I'm still on the fence. Just
okay.
And the reason why I'm on the fence, it's not anything to do with this game. It's more to do with, do I have enough of these already?
That's kind of also what I'm saying too.
Yeah, I have like two-player 10, 11 two-player dueling games right now. And I'm like, I don't know that I need another one. So I'm going to, you know, maybe watch a little bit more and see if there's anything unique here. And these are some of my favorite games of all time. So they're not like games I'm not going to play. If I have one another player and we want to sit down and play a game, a dueling game that takes a couple hours, I could pull like a dozen off the shelf. So
yeah,
it's
a
hard.
There's a lot of competition for that slot, right?
Right.
Your Lord of the Rings, the card game, or the actual board game Rebellion, and endless numbers of like. And again, I think that's also, it's a conversation to have, or maybe a competition to have at some point, where it's like, what's the best player count as far as the games are concerned, right? So like solo games have their own kind of thing. I think almost solo games are almost their own animal, whereas like two-player games are kind of the best at, like, it's the kind of the best player count, with maybe the exception of the four-player, right? Like your standard Euro, it's a four-player game. You typically can get three or four players,
Right.
But two players is like right there. I mean,
there's just something about that two player asymmetrical formula, though. Like, it's so well balanced in a good game. In a good game, there's a lot of bad ones, too. But there's only the two sides, and you can run in against themselves over and over again and kind of find the balancing point. When you have four or five factions and they're all playing together, it's a lot harder to balance that, I would imagine, because you have to find all the different permutations of how they're going to play and who's doing what and where they're going to do it.
Yeah.
In this, you have. There's the Ironclad and the Woodwalkers.
Yeah.
Let's see how they operate. And that's, it's going to make a much more, I just assume the game is going to be well balanced and work really well because it's Mindclash.
Yes.
It's two player. It's asymmetrical. Doesn't mean it will be, but I assume it will be in the same way that a lot of these other ones are.
Yeah. It's got a root look as far as the board's concerned. Mm-hmm. I think the artwork is way too generic. I wish it looked different, or it was a different vibe to it, just so it stood out a little bit. I think more information, like you said, I think this is a hard, this is a bucket that has a lot of good games in.
Sure.
So, Mindclash is always, I own a good chunk of Mindclash, and not all, I don't know if I own all of Mindclash, no, but a good chunk at least. So, yeah. And again, like you said, not a bad price.
Yeah, no, not at all.
All right. Well, I just recently got an email about an upcoming game. This game is Yonder. This is not currently up anywhere as far as picking up or backing or anything like that, but it will be eventually up on Kickstarter. This is from Sinister Fish. So you may know Sinister Fish from Villagers, Streets. I think probably the more recent game was Moon that came out with a worker placement game. So this is supposed to be, or was initially kind of, I guess, teased that this was going to be their heavier kind of board game. They have like three or four mid-weight kind of games, and this was supposed to be like more of their heavy stuff. Artwork looks very similar, same kind of artwork that we've seen previously. Now it's got more of a fantasy kind of look to it. And basically it all comes down to the workers. And in this case, new workers coming to your land from yonder. So they're taking ships out to your land and they're looking for different things. You got your goblins, and goblins are awesome because they arrive in pairs. Dwarves are great because they're better at building and trading. Elves are awesome because they occupied worker slots. Skeletons don't need food, which I think is kind of obvious, but sure. I guess we're feeding our people here. Ogres produce double resources and food. And then each round, you'll have to make decisions for the different people that you have here to decide what works best to build your city. And the buildings come as far as cards are concerned, where you're going to place different workers. So you'll be able to produce resources. Again, a lot of the standard stuff as far as stone and food. But then you'll also be able to upgrade to more exotic kind of materials or looking for mine kind of stuff. There's ongoing effects. There's end game effects. There's ships that come in, kind of like Keyflower, as far as resources and unlocking special abilities and rewards that you can kind of match up with as far as contracts are concerned. I'm a man who likes a good contract. And then there's envoys. There are special characters in each of these different classes that I already spoke about that give you opportunities to do different things with resources to get special benefits and rewards. So we just talked about Mind Clash. It's one of my favorite companies of all time. Sinister Fish is probably the other as far as bringing out some really cool stuff. So newsletter is out. You could probably check it out right now as far as following it. And it'll be coming out on Kickstarter at some point in 2024.
Yeah, I saw this newsletter yesterday, right?
It yeah.
Just announced it.
Just came out.
It's cool looking. I like all Garter's games.
Yeah.
So it's a no-brainer for me. Like, I'll definitely check it out. But it's interesting, though. Like, there's something different about the artwork that I can't quite place. It's a higher contrast, maybe.
Mm.
It looks kind of Photoshop-y?
Is that
a word? Like, I don't know. Like, you're the more aesthetic guy, but something just looks a little off about the artwork, whereas the other games and from this company don't. And I don't love it. I like the sense of humor, but I don't love the way it's being presented here. I can't quite pinpoint why.
I think in the other games that they've come out with previously, the artwork was more about icons and even the characters were more, I wouldn't say iconic, but like as far as like the people were like a standard figure and then like slight variations. And there was a lot of icons. This seems to be, they've taken the artwork into like out of that icon kind of territory into actual cartoony artwork. There's still some semblance of that very kind of like, I don't know what to call it, like a paper doll or paper cut, kind of early South Park where everything had those kind of edges to them. Mm-hmm. But now it seems like an actual cartoony looking game instead of a throwback to like something along the lines of like Glory to Rome, the Black Box edition, where things were just like icons. And if there were figures in that, the figures had a very, print icon look to them. This looks like cartoon. This is we've now moved, I would say, further down the road. Now it's like 80% cartoony.
Yeah, almost. I don't love it. It's like going for that. I just don't feel like this art style works in 3D. Like
But
I mean, that's a small thing. I'm like, artwork doesn't usually stop me from liking anything. It jumped out at me.
No, definitely.
I love worker placement. I love the fantasy thing. I like the sense of humor that these games have. They're very quirky. So I'm psyched for it. I think it'll be cool.
Nice. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I really want them to delve into more of a heavy or more of a complex, or hopefully very streamlined, which they're kind of known for, but a more meaningful kind of gameplay system. Moon was okay. It wasn't everything I wanted it to be. And it, you know, was a little bumpy. So I'm hoping that this is a little more streamlined, but I agree. I think I wish they would have taken it back a little bit to more of the villagers kind of look, because I think that just, it plays a lot better. All right. Well, that's everything we want to get to the table. Let's talk about the games we did get to the table. And we'll let you know if those games are a buy and you should run out and pick those games up. If those games are a play and you should sit down and enjoy them. If those games are a dodge and you should avoid them. Or if, in fact, those games are the dreaded burn. And dear God, just burn those poor suckers, because they're not worth it, man. Just don't even talk about it. You know, it's the games that should not be named.
Yeah. Yeah. Thankfully, that's not what I'm talking about.
What?
No, I'm doing something great. This is a good game.
Not a burn?
Not a burn.
Oh, opposite. Spoilers.
Yeah. Well, so the thing is like, life's been busy, right? It's been hard to get like new games to the table. It's been hard to get out of the house.
Old games are awesome.
So I'm dipping back into the well, and I'm like getting out of that groove of like, I got to play this new game. I got to learn the rules and I got to figure it out and track people down. And it's exhausting. So, I'm dipping into the old stuff that I can play just, you know, in the house with people here or by myself. And Mage Knight Ultimate Edition hit the table for me all this last week. So this is a game that we've talked about a bunch over the years, but I don't think we ever formally reviewed it.
We did not.
And part of the reason for that is it just kind of filtered into my life and just became a part of my gaming habits, but it was never like a thing we played when it was new, right? This game's been out for a very long time. The original version came out, I want to say 2011, 2010. Been out for a good 15 years. So the Ultimate Edition was released in 2018, and it is exactly as it sounds. It is the Ultimate Edition of Mage Knight, except not really anymore, because there's a new expansion coming at the end of this year. So do that with that as you will. I don't know if they'll roll it in or not. But this is like the game from Vlada Shivatl for like solo players. Like, now Shivatl has a lot of the games, one of the highest hit rates of any game designer out there. Like some of the most iconic, best beloved games of all time, including like Through the Ages, Dungeon Lords, Codenames. Right. And then this one here, Mage Knight. And so it's a game that for a while was a little overwhelming to me. I kind of avoided it, but I did pick up a copy. I played it back in Pittsburgh. And then there was Star Trek Frontiers that came out, which is a Star Trek version of this that was re-implemented by our friend Andrew Parks. And for a while, I kind of alternated between them and obviously playing a million other things. But Mage Knight made it back to my table last year. With somebody I met locally who wanted to get the game played, and I was like, oh, that's right, I love this. This game is very good. And that was with two people, which takes forever. So the game for me has always been kind of a solo experience, to the point, and I think a lot of people agree on this, if you go to the top solo games list, there's a guild, the one player guild on Board Game Geek, and they do a top 100 every year. For a very long time, Mage Knight was number one. Now it's Spirit Island, but Mage Knight is still up there, like top two, top three. And the reason for that is just, it's an adventure game. It's a game where you have a little figure and you explore and adventure and fight things, but it is absolutely not like roll dice and hack and slash at things, which is what a lot of adventure games are, which I find kind of boring. I'm just not a huge fan of that. Mage Knight is a puzzle. It's a hand management. I don't want to use the word deck building, because you're not really building. I mean, you are, but not really, because you don't play the game long enough to really build a deck. But you are cycling through a small deck of cards and trying to use them in the most efficient way possible to accomplish a complex array of goals that include exploring and fighting and conquering things. You play a Mage Knight, who is one of these little terribly painted figures. This is a WizKids game, so the painting is terrible. And each of these Mage Knights has their own deck of cards, and they have their own skills. And as you explore the map, which will kind of unfold in front of you, you will level up and gain skills and add the ability to add more units, and you'll get new advanced actions and spells that go into your deck. And you're able to use all of those things, right? So the real thing that makes this game so much fun, and the reason why it's such a great solo game, is that every turn, when you have a hand of cards in front of you, you'll have five cards, but other ways to get more cards. You look at the board, which is these tiles that kind of build out over time, and you try to figure out what is the most efficient way to do the thing I need to do on this turn. Also, what do I actually need to do on this turn, right? Because the ultimate goal of the solo game is to reveal the two cities at the end of the map and conquer them. So you have to explore a bunch because you got to get those nine tiles out. But you also then have to find the cities and conquer them. So you need to build up enough strength and have enough units and have enough spells and have enough mana saved up that you could then take out those cities, which is difficult to do. So you want to be as efficient as possible, but you also want to do all the cool stuff, right? I want to go to that Wizard's Keep over there because I can take it out, I can conquer it, and then I get some free spells. It's awesome. I want to go burn down the monastery because then I get to pull an artifact from the deck. You know, these are decisions you get to make. They're not things you have to do, but you want to do all of them. So you have to kind of be careful, like, okay, I'm going to have to pick and choose where I'm going to go, how I'm going to get there. Movement is very difficult in general. Like, it costs a lot to move around on the board. So you can't just, like, flitter around all over the place. You have to be efficient, and you have to solve the puzzle every single round. So an introductory game, which is 4 rounds, 2 days and 2 nights, takes like 1.5 hours, 2 hours playing it solo, right? If you've never played it before, if you're just relearning the rules. The full solo conquest is a 2 to 3 hour game, right? Unless you really know what you're doing and it's like flying through those cards. But for me, you know, I take my time, I try to figure it out. And that's what's the reason I love Mage Knight so much, because it is a game that gives me the permission to go AP as much as I want, because I'm not slowing anybody down, and the game rewards me for doing it, right? If I play a Euro game solo, eventually I'm just like, I just want to take my turn. I just want to keep moving. I want to keep doing stuff, keep building my engine. Mage Knight encourages and rewards me for slowing down, thinking, getting the best possible combinations, and then firing them off. And it's just a lot of fun. So the Ultimate Edition comes with the base game. Obviously, it comes with the Lost Legion, which is the big box expansion, and then the Shades of Tesla, which is the smaller box, and then there's a Krang character expansion. So these are the three expansions that came out over the course of, I guess, like 5 years or so after the game came out, which is good because there was some weird misprinting stuff along the way. Like the Krang expansion in particular did not fit the card backs. There are different colors and stuff, so you would know when those cards were coming up. The new version doesn't add a ton of new stuff. It gives you new rule books that kind of integrate all the rules together. There's 5 new cards, that's basically it, and then like whatever revisions came in those expansions. The earlier printings of the Ultimate Edition, not the best in terms of like the layout in the box. The insert, some of the quality stuff was not great, but from what I've heard, the newer editions are really solid. This is one of the best games of all time for solo play. So that's it. And if you're a solo gamer, you're like, yeah, duh. If you're listening to this, but it's still fun and it's worth me coming on and saying this because I've gotten it back to the table. I've been playing it a lot lately and it's just reminding me like, oh, right. I love this. This is great. And it's a good reminder because there's a new expansion coming out later this year, which I'm excited for because it's more content for this game that I love. And hopefully we'll get to the table more often now because it was like buried on the top shelf. It's a big, stupid box, the Ultimate Edition. It doesn't fit in the Kalax. And it could have, like, the layout of this box is not great. It could have fit into the Kalax if they put it in a different format, but whatever. But it is just a fantastic experience. So obviously a buy. A must have. It's in my top 100. I think it's in my top 10. So Mage Knight Ultimate Edition, that's what I've been playing. Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, no, I as far as being on this podcast with you for obviously forever and listening to everything as far as solo players are concerned, when I think you gave me your copy of the Star Trek version of it, I was like, oh yeah, because love me some Star Trek, and especially if it plays as well or nearly as well as Mage Knight, I certainly want to get that to the table. So is it just having not played Mage Knight, is it fundamentally different? Like, is Mage Knight, it's Mage Knight, right? Like, that's the version you want to pick up if you pick up a version.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. Like, I know people who like Frontiers better. Uh-huh. but I think it's because they like Star Trek better.
All right.
Like,
sure.
Like, so for you, I think that would be an easy note, you know,
yes.
Difference. I don't remember. The thing is, like, I played Mage Knight, and then several years later, I played Star Trek Frontiers, and then several years later, I got back to Mage Knight when I picked up the Ultimate Edition.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really remember, like, what the significant differences are. There are differences. There have to be, just for thematic purposes. And, you know, you're not one individual exploring. You are a ship, you know, exploring the galaxy. And you do recruit things, you know, crew and stuff the same way. But it's, I don't know. I liked it a lot. It was just one of those things, like, I don't need both of these.
Sure. And
I really like the fantasy themes, so Mage Knight for me. But
gotcha.
I think you'd like Star Trek. You should play it.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. All right. Well, I got a couple of games to the table this week. Let's start with two games that I received review copies from Smirk and Dagger. First up is Tesseract. This was a game that was on Kickstarter last year, and I finally got a chance to get to the table. You probably know about this game because it's a giant cube of dice, and it's on the cover is really evocative. It's got this hand with all this kind of like spatial phenomenon kind of floating out of it. And that's because humanity stands on the brink as this arrival of this powerful, destructive, extra-dimensional Tesseract, this square cube, has come into existence. And it's a co-op game where you and the world's best minds have come together to try to figure out this artifact, try to break it down before it melts down and destroys time and space and everything else. So, yeah, that sounds threatening and explosive and destruction. Not to worry, it's an abstract. So,
hey,
basically, there's a couple of elements I really do want to note before getting into the review. First off is, as I mentioned, it's a cube made of dice, of all different colored dice, of D6s, but they don't look like D6s because instead of the typical numbers, they have these symbols that you can still make out the number of points on the dice. So it's not overly complicated, like which symbol goes to what. No, it probably makes sense. Second is this Tesseract stands on this cardboard and plastic Lazy Susan, little tiny thing. So you and your friends at the table will have an opportunity to spin this very gently around so that the dice don't go flying and, again, end of time and space and stuff like that. So, bravo to Smirk and Dagger for such a good production. The dice are colorful. They don't look like traditional dice, and the nice little Lazy Susan is awesome to play with. The rest of the game itself, also very colorful. Iconography, some really nice artwork. Anthony, I know you mentioned you like more of that kind of icon, kind of like cutouts. Seems to fit like this. The board itself, as far as you're trying to take all of these different cubes from this, you know, 64 custom dice, more or less off, because they come off without you wanting them to, but you also take them off yourself, and based upon the glyphs that are on these different dice, you are trying to get them off the Tesseract into your lab, and then by taking a number of different actions, which I'll talk about in a minute, you'll be able to put them onto like a lockdown board, which now the Tesseract's kind of crazy energies is now contained. Whew, that's a lot to say for an abstract. Now, what happens about the cubes? Well, at the start of the game, you take off a couple of cubes to get the game started. But basically, the actions are remove the cubes, right? Because you got to remove the cubes in order to do things with the cubes. And the remove cubes come into your lab. Now, what you want to do is to fill up that player board where the numbers run from 1 to 6. And again, there are 4 different colors in the game. So you're just trying to match up. It's a giant puzzle in a cube form. It's not very complicated, but it's a co-op game. So how you adjust the different glyphs on these, you know, Tesseract cubes is essential. So you remove them to basically draft them to your board. Then you can adjust them. You get to move them up one up or down one by one. Now, here's the co-op element. if you don't feel like you're going to be able to do much of anything with them, you can transfer them to another player's board, their lab, so that they can kind of manipulate them based upon their actions, some cards that give them special abilities, and their own special asymmetric kind of power that their particular scientist researcher has. So everyone has unique abilities that their research allows to do. One is kind of like an ongoing active ability on the card, and one is a chosen action, because you take three actions in turn, and one of the actions can be from this special card. So sometimes it makes sense to transfer this to someone else because their particular researcher might deal with this cube a lot better. So those unique actions are really important. At the end of the turn, you're trying, the Tesseract sheds off cubes, which is dangerous because now stuff starts really happening very quickly. And you can lose the game because it's a co-op, right? So the game against you and your friends at the table. So breaches happen when it goes all the way up to 7 and everything goes boom because 3 prime cubes are there. And then ideally winning is with you and your whole team getting those cubes out together, out to the table together. Now, as far as challenges are concerned, I mean, financially, the game is relatively inexpensive. It's $50 for a copy of the game. If you'd like to get this special version with the funky looking metal dice that come along with it, it's going to add significant money. It's going to be $130. So those dice are very expensive, but they're also very nice to play with. I think most people kind of prefer that over, you know, the traditional stuff. The game itself is easy to put together. It's a co-op game. You can play this solo. It obviously, the solo mode is very easy. It allows you to play two-handed so that you can have two researchers. And that's good because you do need the researchers' unique abilities to be able to deal with the different cubes that come off. So you might want to pick certain, you know, researcher abilities that kind of work really well together. So it's a co-op game. We pass, but we failed more often than not. And again, that's generally just a good mark of a co-op game. There can be a lot of AP in this game because you do want to manage the cubes and you do look at the cubes on the Tesseract. And the way in which you remove them, 3 sides have to be available, including, you know, one of the sides can be the top. So you just don't want to take cubes off to kind of work on those individual cubes. You want to take cubes off so that you can open up other cubes that you'll be able to benefit you long term, that you can kind of manipulate to put on the board because you need certain cubes to match. This is a very good educational game. It's a very good co-op game because it's very small, very compact. It's not difficult to put the Tesseract together. They give you guides to put the dice together on that. But it kind of has that pandemic mechanic where there are colors of 4 different types, just like in Pandemic, and they're spiraling out of control, and you have to manipulate those kind of factions or energies or viruses in order to kind of deal with them and put them off the board. And obviously, the further the game goes on, the more stuff that comes off, the more nasty abilities come opening. So it's a challenging game. AP prone, but you can play this solo, which I enjoyed playing it solo because I like to take the time to kind of work out the calculations. Playing with a group, a little bit more difficult, but I would still recommend it because you want to have more brains at the table, so to speak. And I think that works out really well. So Tesseract gets a play for me. It's a definitely an enjoyable abstract game and a co-op game that really allows you to play how would you say it? Like an in-depth puzzle or a cooperative kind of, I wouldn't say math making so much, but like everyone has a role, like almost like in the algorithm, like you'll do these things and you'll do those things. We'll pass this along. And then if we can kind of put together that formula, things will work out. So puzzle or formula building, I think. So yeah, Tesseract gets a play. Yay.
Sounds great. Abstract even, and you're like, oh good.
Yeah, I like that it keeps you engaged as far as like everything is falling down, and the abstract nature of it is really straightforward, and it's very much puzzle it out or create some sort of formula to kind of deal with a couple of dice, and it doesn't stray, it doesn't overstay its welcome, I think. I find a lot of abstracts do overstay their welcome, and then you're doing the same thing over and over. You're doing the same thing over and over here, but it's on the shorter side.
That's good.
All right, next up is Behexed. Behexed was another Kickstarter game that came out back in, is it also? Yeah, back also in 2023. This is the other side. This is the smirk and dagger kind of side. This reminds me of Cutthroat Caverns. You play one of these powerful magicians, all different types. And I'm going to explain at first the layout, or like the physical layout of the game, because I think it explains a lot of the game. Now, first up, you get one of these battle mages. Now, these battle mages have what they call player mats, but I would never call these player mats. They're basically cardboard discs at the table. If you've ever played Betrayal on the House on the Hill, you know that kind of, you know, I would say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Pentagons? Octagon? I don't know. 6 or 7-sided kind of cardboard disc where you have that marker that goes around. That's what you're dealing with. That's your character. Now, some of the production here is a down for me, because this was a Kickstarter, so there is a better version of this, but the standard version that is available to, you know, if you buy the basic game, is a little bit, I don't know, it's way too basic for this day and age. I guess that's what I want to say on that. The artwork is very good. The mages have all different play styles, because each mage is going to get a set of cards that have some very basic spells that you're going to need to purchase other spells with, but also to kind of direct your spells. And then a couple of special spells for that particular mage. And then throughout the game, you're doing some kind of deck building where you'll be able to get new spells from the center of the board. And then they go into your hand so that you'll be able to play those spells immediately. Awesome. But again, very, very thin on the cards. The player mats are not really mats. The enchantment tokens, which are a big part of the game because that's really what comes into play, are just kind of really cheap on the cardboard punch out. The iconography on the spell cards are fine. I really do appreciate the graphic design, but I really would have loved to see some artwork on the cards to kind of make me feel like this is a mage battle. So instead of just having that one piece of artwork on the player mat, I could see the actions. So that was also kind of a downgrade for me. So basically the game, as far as setup is concerned, is you're going to have everyone's going to have their player mat, giant kind of cardboard thing. And then there's going to be a marketplace, so to speak, of different spells that you'll be able to purchase. And then you'll have your hand of spells. And basically this comes down to playing what they called like hot potato. You're going to have the opportunity to pick cards to kind of add to your hand to make yourself more powerful. And the more cards you get and the more powerful that they are, these will do different things. There's cards that allow for deflections. That'll be important for a minute. Enhanced deflections, also very important. Charms, and then your straight up behex and disruptions. Basically, what you're trying to do is knock down the magical power of the other players at the table. So you send out a spell, they counter the spell or redirect the spell, and then it maybe comes back to you. You counter or redirect it, and or enhance it, or lower some defenses, or play some more powerful cards. And basically, it's hot potato, right? Nobody wants to get hit by the bad stuff. So that bounces around throughout the game. There are 4 major rounds in the game of doing all this kind of fun stuff where you're trying to shoot at each other. So very Cutthroat Caverns. And, you know, the person with the most or the highest score on their playmat wins. So it's not a very complicated game. Good artwork as far as the player characters are concerned. Like the asymmetry of their play style. And there's really some really, really cool kind of backstory of the different characters and what their spells should be doing. I do think that they missed out. I do appreciate the graphic design a lot, but I do think that they missed out on putting some additional artwork. I feel like this is a more bare bones production. Now, that being said, if you went to Kickstarter, you would have the opportunity to also purchase the upgraded deluxe kind of version that does have an actual playmat where you can set up all the cards. This is their conjuring wheel, a neoprene mat, sleeves, because the cards need sleeves. The sleeves are very poor quality. Boo. but the game itself is fun for a light kind of attack your friends at the table. I don't happen to be an attack of friends at the table kind of guy, but if you have a very short amount of time, I think this played about 30 to 45 minutes, where once we got into the game, we were kind of throwing down stuff and just bang, bang, bang kind of situation. The really cool thing about the game is it has additional mastery packs. Basically, this adds additional characters into the game with their own special abilities, and also adds additional cards and play features. That's really where this game kind of pops a little bit. So I would say play the first basic edition. It says like play more and more and get kind of build up. I would say play the first edition, like it. If you do, continue to play, but play with the higher functioning stuff, because that's where the game really pops. So Behex gets a light play for me. I think it's just fine. I think it is what it's supposed to be. It's nothing more than that. I wish it was more than that. I know a friend of mine has a copy of this as well. We got to play it. So, yeah, Behex. That's okay.
All right. Yeah, I mean, it's... Everything you described, I'm like, that is not a game for me. But I could see why the people who like that kind of game are like, yeah, this is
yeah. Good. And finally, I'll go through one final game, if I would, Anthony, here. I got a chance to play Skyrise. This was a game that we had seen at a couple of different conventions recently. And it was on Kickstarter back in recently, 2024, 2023. We got to see the base version of this. What this game is at least kind of known for, at least at the convention circuit, was the beautiful high production from Roxley Games here. This is the game that has the floating city. And it's an auction game in which you're placing down buildings, beautifully, you know, beautiful plastic PVC buildings that you place down there. Or you could get the more basic kind of wood meeple looking buildings that you place down the table. Now, I think one of the problems I have with this is not the game itself, but I think as far as their marketing campaign goes, I don't think this is an auction game. And the reason why is, basically, at the start of the game, you get a player. There's no special initial player power here. It's just a player board. It's some cool artwork. And it gives you an opportunity to collect tokens that will act for multipliers based upon what color sections you claim by the end of the game. Beyond that, you get buildings. Now, what's interesting about the buildings is they are typical kind of Art Nouveau kind of buildings on the table, all these different artistic styles. On the bottom of the buildings is a number. Every player has different numbers escalating. So from like one all the way up to like 121 or so. But you as a player have different numbers. So you might have 5, you might have 17, you might have 37, you might have 95. I have 112. I have 3, I have 7, like we all have all different numbers. So when the game starts, the first player chooses where to place their first building on the player board. Now the player board has all these different color sections, again, that match up to the tokens that will be multipliers at the end of the game, but also on these sections are sometimes different iconography representing different aspects of the city. There are a number of global kind of goals, and you will score those goals for each round. So as you play through, maybe the windmills will score you points, or basically how you surround a lake will score you points. In addition to that, there is a token on every section. Some of the tokens match up with the tokens that go onto your player board from multipliers for area control. And some of the tokens are actual letters that represent bonuses that you will get to the end of the game based upon the patron discs. So at the top of the board, there's a bunch of patrons. And they each of the different patrons, A, B, C, and D, they have different values that are randomly shuffled. So you don't know which letter has 3, 4, 5, or 8 points. As the game goes on, you'll pick up these letters and get to see what's on the other side. So you have a sense of, maybe I got lucky and I found out what the 8 is. So I want to get a lot of, you know, tokens based that are based on that 8. Or maybe I don't have that token yet, but I could figure out which ones I should shoot for. So the game starts. Someone puts down a building. They claim that area based upon a number. Let's say it's number 14. Now, it's not an auction for that spot. And we'll talk about Ra in a little bit at the end of the episode. It's not an auction for that spot or that tile on that board. It's just a starting bid to claim something for that particular turn. So you played a 14, I came back and played a 25, but the 25 has to be in an adjacent section to the where the initial bid went down. And then the next player, and you could play this up to 4 players, gets a place of building down, again, adjacent. So you also have to take into consideration the fact that as people are placing buildings out, they're opening up new sections for you to bid on. So it doesn't just stay at that initial bid. It could. Someone could say, you want that section and you're playing a 91? Take it. I don't want that. It's not worth it for me. But as the game goes on, you're kind of sneaking your way to new sections. And again, maybe you want a certain token for a multiplier because you have a lot of brown areas. Or maybe you're trying to collect a certain letter because you know it's worth 8 points. So there is that kind of like, I want to keep the auction going to get to that area. But also they could stop and I would get stuck with that particular position. So you're auctioning, but primarily what you're doing is, again, what I feel like you're doing is a trick-taking mechanism. You play a number, they play a number. Do I want to win, right? Do I want to win that trick? Do I want to win that area? And again, because all the numbers are visible to everybody, you know exactly what how they can outbid you if they choose to do so. But again, you want to use up all your buildings as quickly as possible to claim as many areas. But at the end of the game, you must use all your buildings. First one to use all the buildings scores 10 additional points. Second player, 4 additional points. And basically, you want to match the global goals. You also have in the second round a particular goal for your monument. Your monument is a special building that doesn't have a number, but basically acts as like a trump card. And that allows you to claim that area no matter what someone has previously put down. But also, based upon one of your selected special powers for that, that's also going to give you a special ability to score additional points. This is very abstract as far as points are concerned. There's no thematic kind of playthrough here. You're trying to control sections of the board. You're trying to control multiplier tokens to match up with whatever colors you're getting. And you're trying to collect letters that match up with certain points you score at the end of the game. There's also a wild token. There's also a +1 that will give you +1 for your tokens. And basically, once the game comes to an end, you'll take a look at the global goals. You'll take a look at the private goals along with your monument goals, and you'll see whoever has the most points wins. What I really liked about this game, which was surprising to me, was it wasn't just like you put a number, I put a number, you have the highest number, you claim that area. It was the fact that it built out and away from that section. So I didn't think strategically, if I want, you know, the brown areas, then I need to play into the auction a little bit and hopefully guide people to a certain section. Or if there's a token that scores a lot of points and I know I can't claim it, I don't want to continue to play there, or I want to play somewhere else so that it can guide you to a new area. So I would say Sky Rise again was one of those games I was completely ready to dismiss. I thought it was beautiful. The Super Deluxe version of it has just beautiful, you know, buildings to it. It has nice little skyships to it. It has really nice cards to it. I don't think you need the fancy version. It also has like the 3D kind of building to it. The regular kind of basic edition, essential edition, is also very fine and very inexpensive. So whatever version you go with, I think you're going to have a very good game. It's a pretty high play for me. I enjoyed it a lot. And that's Skyrise.
That's great. Yeah, it's a pretty looking game.
It's a very nice looking game. And I think one of the things we always talked about with components, as far as like, do I want to buy the deluxe version, is how much am I going to hold those components or manipulate those components so that it's worth it, right? Like you buy a first player marker, like this Kickstarter is like, hey, this is a first player marker. It's like, it's amazing. It's this gigantic, I don't know, trophy made of like solid gold. And like, this is a first player marker, man. We barely touch it. We don't even use it in our games. But like here, you are manipulating the buildings. They do have value for you as far as where and how you play them. Once they're flipped over in their buildings, sometimes height matters. They don't really aesthetically change the game, but the high production, I would say, is worth it, but not necessary.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Like, especially coming from Rocket League games, it's kind of their deal. Like, but it's good that it's good though, because like, I mean, we've seen this at conventions for years.
Yeah.
And then in their kind of preview version, I'm like, it's really pretty, but it doesn't look like much gameplay wise. So it's good to hear that it's a little bit more than it looks
like. Yeah, I was surprised. I thought this was going to be a straight up, like, I put a number here, you put a number here. Oh, well, right. You won. But it was more like strategic, like, I wanted you to win that spot because now you open up a new avenue for me to play on.
Right.
And I also don't need that color, so it doesn't matter to me. Or I'm trying to get you away from that token, so I like that extra dimension there. I think it saves the game from just being a one note. All right, so that's everything that hit our table this week. Now on to our feature review. Our feature review this week, of course, is the top 10 Reiner Knizia games. The greatest. I'm telling you, some of the greatest work that's out there. Anthony mentioned all the games out there. There's a lot of games that he's produced. I mean, these are not just tic-tac-toe games. These are very, very good games. So we went through his extensive list, picked out our top 10. Your top 10 may vary, but this is our top 10. And I'm pretty happy with this, Anthony. I own pretty much all of these as far as my top 10 are concerned.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's crazy. Like when somebody has produced 700 games, of which like 200 or 300 legitimately have come out and been decent in the time we've been playing games. It's hard to like narrow it down to top 10, but we did. These are the 10 that were like, we would gladly sit down and play anytime. And, you know, it's funny because we're like, oh, Reiner Knizia is in the news. He's on the hotness. I'm like, he's always in the news. He's always in the hotness. Dude has a new game every 25 minutes. But his new one, Rebirth, which I talked about in my acquisition disorder a couple months ago, is up on Kickstarter now from Mighty Boards. We did not cover it this week because we covered it before, but it's an interesting looking little tile laying game. Of course, abstract, but very pretty, as kind of the theme in a lot of these games we're going to talk about today is Reiner Knizia games used to be like, here's a brown token and here's a hex map.
There you go.
The brown token represents a castle. The hex map is a map of Japan or something. And you're like, how? Why? This is play a tic-tac-toe with hexes.
It's true.
But now it's at least pretty tic-tac-toe with X.
Which is funny because he's known for his bow ties.
Right.
Yeah. He's a snazzy dresser. Like if you ever see him at conventions, yeah, yeah, wearing a suit and a bow tie, and you're like, that guy. He's got his stuff together.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, no, it's funny. But yeah, I would say of the games we're talking about today, all but a couple have some pretty nice, pretty new versions that you could pick from. And I think these are all in print too. So good looking games. They're not like the stodgy, dry looking old things that, you know, Reiner Knizia. Well, I mean, part of it too is he started producing games in the 90s. So,
yeah, the production can't keep up with them. He's like, I produced a new game. We're like, oh, dear God, man.
Just grab more brown cubes from the box.
He's like the Doctor Who of gaming, right? Just
right, yeah. Right. All right. So, I'll kick it off here. We're going to do a top 10, so we'll alternate. Number 10 is a game that came out in 2021 with minimal fanfare. I say minimal fanfare, but it was nominated or recommended with the Kenner Spiel in 2022. And so not nominated fully for the award, but recommended as like, you should also play these games. It's called Witchstone. It's a game that I picked up at Gen Con. Was it Gen Con? It must have been PAX that year. This was post-COVID. But this is a game in which you are kind of building out your own little personal cauldron, and that's going to allow you to take different types of actions. So the more stuff you do, the better you get at doing that. So you have all these different little pieces kind of going on. And it, so if you look at it, like a preview of the game, there are little, you know, meeples and little, you know, clear pieces and all these different things like in this giant cauldron crisscrossing across each other. And then like a separate grid of different things that you've picked up. And then your own personal cauldron has a bunch of little tiles on it that kind of combine and create these different rows and columns of potential actions. So it reminds me a little bit of like a bonfire from Stefan Feld, where like the order in which you put things and how they interact with each other is going to determine the actions that are available to you. And I found that to be very compelling as a game. It's also relatively inexpensive. This is a game that it was brought to the US by R&R Games. Their games are generally very cheap. So it's like $35 for a decent midweight Euro with... It's not the strongest theme in the world, but I don't think any Kinesia game is the strongest theme in the world. But it's solid, and it's a good, solid production. So Witchstone is was one of the more surprising games that came out of that year for me. It made it to my top 10, and it is our number 10 and our top 10 for Reiner Kinesia games, Witchstone.
Yeah, no, absolutely. All right, our number 9 is something we just talked about recently. An excellent, excellent two-player game. This is Lost Cities. This was a game that, again, back in the day, I was like, oh, it's kind of a straight up numbers on a card kind of game. I don't know if I really want to play this. And then I played it, and it's awesome because the game is not very heavy as far as thematics are concerned, right? You're going on all of these different explorations, all these different lost cities, very color coded kind of game as far as that's concerned. But the table, basically, you have a board and you're playing against another explorer and you're trying to get out these cards in order to kind of paint out this kind of journey that you're taking. So as the cards lay out in order, the journey becomes more robust. So seems rather simple, but again, you have an opponent playing against you. So as you play cards out, it gives them an opportunity to pick cards up that you're not using, that they can now use. And since you're both working off the same deck, if it doesn't work for you, it absolutely works for them. So you might want to hold some cards in your hand to hold them back a little bit longer. But as you hold the cards back in your hand, it kind of blocks you from doing a lot of things at the table. It certainly has, it's one of those games, easy to play, difficult to master. There's some nasty point losses as far as that's concerned. It has a very great app that I played solo a ton of times versus AI. It's a really fine, great game, very inexpensive. I think Cosmos typically puts it out. Lost Cities, excellent, excellent game.
Great, great game. And like 40 versions of this.
Oh, yeah.
Implementations and updates. The board game version of this, which was preceded by a different board game version called Keltis, won the Spiel des Jahres in 2008, 9 years later, and then was re-implemented back as Lost Cities, the board game. So it's like, this game is like eating its own tail. And they're all good. So
yeah,
whatever version you want.
And I have the card game and the board game. I just double checked.
Oh, yes. Nice. Yeah. I mean, they're unique enough and it's worth having both.
Yeah. Very simple to play. Don't get freaked out, but it's one of those games that's like almost like chess, like very difficult to master as far as that's concerned. Brilliant, brilliant game.
All right. Next up, I have a almost pure abstract strategy game, of which a few of these are, and which Kinesia is very well known for. This one's called Blue Lagoon. It came out in 2018 from Blue Orange Games here in the U.S., and it is a game about the settlers traveling out on from the islands. Think Moana. Think Moana. Like the artwork is very Moana.
Gotcha.
And spreading out to these different islands and settling those. So it's played over two phases. You have the exploration phase in which you're kind of moving out, and then the settlement phase in which you're kind of laying out tokens. either settlers or village tokens, and those will determine where you can kind of go from there. So it's all about trying to manage where things go and the combinations of pieces and the amount of points that you get when you place those pieces. It's very simple. I remember playing this game with my daughter when she was like 5 or 6 years old, which makes sense. It's from Blue Orange, but it's emergent strategy and complexity. Like, there's a lot here to work with, and I've had a lot of fun playing with this with other gamers as well. So it's one of those abstract strategy games that works very well with four players, takes less than 45 minutes, and can also accommodate families. And there aren't a lot of those, because they either become too complex or too abstract, or they're too gray or too drab, or something. And this one kind of finds a sweet spot between all of those for this sublime, colorful gaming experience. Highly recommended. Blue Lagoon.
Very, very nice. All right. Again, not as you know, Anthony's a friend of the abstracts. I admire the abstracts. I generally kind of look the other way sometimes when they hit the table, because I'm just like, eh. I got a chance to play Samurai. And Samurai is all about hexes. Very simple board of Japan. And little screens in which you hold your pieces. And the piece count is very simple. I think I got more of the modern production of this. I know that initially it had little kind of chits that you can play with. But basically, you're looking to gain the favor of three different factions. There's samurais, peasants, and priests. And each of them are represented by very simple, iconic elements. So there's helmets, rice paddies, and there's Buddhas on the board. And as the game goes on, you are placing these out on the tile because you're trying to curry favor with these three different factions. And there isn't a lot of like direct interaction, but the game is always very intense because the areas are very limited and you're trying to gain the most favor from those particular factions. So it is a fun and dynamic, but a very serious thinking kind of game. The multipliers that are on the game are very essential for your success, and it's just a great deal of fun. Samurai.
Ah, I love Samurai. We need a big, fancy, pretty version of this.
It's a good version. I mean, the newer version's good.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. But I want like...
You want a fan?
We'll talk about a game later, but I want that.
I got you. I mean, Samurai is what? It's got to be like 9 years old now at this point. It's like that...
That version of it? Yeah, I mean, the original is from the 90s, but the current version we have is... I don't even know if it's in print, that version.
I have a copy of it. It's very nice. Ooh, it's very fancy.
All right. Next up for me... Well, for us, but the one I'm talking about is number 6 on the list, and that is The Quest for El Dorado. This is a game that came out in 2017. It was also nominated for the Spiel des Jahres, and it is a deck-building race game. So you play an explorer in the Amazon trying to find the lost city of gold, as do all of your opponents, and you will be building out your deck of cards. Each of these cards will allow you to traverse a different type of terrain. So there's these different hexes. You build a map at the beginning of the game. There's multiple different maps you can build. And you move across those. And so like, okay, I got to get through the jungle. I need machetes. You got to have cards with machete symbols on them. And you got to be able to match the number of machete symbols that you're passing through. And so there's a lot of different types of terrain for that. There's like the deserts and there's the forests. There's water, trying to get across the water. You also have coin cards that let you buy new cards to add to your deck. And so the combination of trying to balance and manage building up your deck with actually moving forward without getting stuck, because if you move too fast and get stuck, people can build up their deck and then kind of pass you, creates this kind of push-pull mechanic within the game that is just like this very sublime, engaging way to play. It's one of those games that my students always, like, they get to choose the games they bring into class, and they often pick this one because of the theme, but then they also engage with it just because mechanically it's so simple. There's been a couple versions of this. There's multiple different versions of the artwork. There's been an expansion or two. But at the end of the day, it's just a clever way to combine the simplicity of deck building, because it's not doing anything crazy or new with the deck building, with a race game using those elements for relatively simple and quick experience. It takes less than an hour. So the quest for El Dorado at number 6.
Very nice. I played that at your place and enjoyed it a great deal.
Yeah, good game.
Another game, Anthony, that you introduced me to is our next number here. It's Medici. You are one of rival merchant families seeking to profit in the 16th century in Florence. This is another, I guess it's like, for in some ways, very quintessential as Ryan and Canizia. You got auctions, man, and you got a somewhat stripped down presentation as far as the different resources that come out on the board. There's 5 different things that you're trying to ship out here. And yet the gameplay, as far as making the calculations and when to press your luck, because what's going to happen is a ship comes to harbor and the ship has all these different goods that will be available for you to kind of pick from. So there are 36 different goods. And as the ship comes out, you, on your turn, you're blindly going to pick out certain different boxes, crates, and flip them over and see what resources are in there. Each of these different resources are going to have a value from 0 to 5. And then there's also a 10 value gold card that comes into play. And then you're going to put that out to the market. So maybe you selected 1, 2, or 3. It comes out to the market. You don't get to bid first. Everyone gets a chance to bid. You get to bid last because you're the player that started the auction. If no one bids, goes off the side because it's not good. If someone's going to win it at some point by bidding, and they take that on to their own supply. Now, you only have a limited space in your supply, so you really want to get the highest numbers possible so that your ship is the most valuable, but also you want to have the most of a type of good because that's going to move you up the pyramid of scoring bonuses. And as that moves up, you go 5, 10, 20 towards the top, that's going to score you additional bonuses. So you're watching everybody else. What are they collecting? As the game goes on, you'll get a sense of where everyone's shooting for based upon a particular good. So sometimes it's worth taking the lower scoring resources because you're going to get the most number of them to go up that pyramid track. But sometimes you just want to have the biggest numbers because that's going to score you points as well. You're basically giving away money to make money. So you don't want to overbid as far as an auction's concerned, because that is certainly going to hurt you. Medici, my friends, own it, play it, try the app. The app is excellent.
Medici is amazing. Yeah, it's one of those games. Like, I backed it, I think, a couple times, different versions of it. It's just cool to have the different artwork.
Yeah.
All right, number 4 on the list is kind of a mishmash because there's a lot of different versions of this game. The original from 1999, kind of original, I should say, is Schottentotten, which re-implements an even older version of the game, which was kind of laid out by Canizia in the 90s, called the Fifth Column, and then was later re-implemented again by GMT as Battle Line, which has then been re-implemented by other versions of Battle Line, and there's now Schottentotten 2. It's a game system. It's been done a bunch, but basically you have a set of 9 different flags or stones or whatever game you're playing. There's like 9 objectives you're trying to capture in between the 2 players. And you play cards to each of these different columns on the battle line, on the Schottentotten, whatever. And you're trying to build a combination that will defeat your opponents. That's it. You want to win 5 of the 9 or get 3 in a row. So you're trying to create these almost poker-style hands where you have like flushes, 3 of a kind, straights. They have numbers on them. The Schottentotten, the original, had 9 different suits of the card or numbers for the cards and no tactics cards. Battle Line introduced the tactics cards, which add a little bit more strategy and complexity to the game. And then they upped the number to 10 with the elephant. Schottentotten now also has those things. So it's kind of this recursive thing, like, which we see that a lot in Reiner Knizia's games, where things are constantly iterating, being updated, building on themselves, taking old stuff from other games and rebuilding. At the end of the day, though, like we talked about 2-player dueling games, this, along with Lost Cities, is one of the best. It's quick. It's like less than 30 minutes. There are multiple ways in which you can play it. It's been re-implemented a dozen different times, but like literally any one of these versions is a fantastic way to play. So Reiner Knizia's Battle Line and or Schottentotten is a great game at number four.
Very nice. This is one of my favorite games from Reiner Knizia, and one of my biggest surprises. I remember way back in the day, the game group putting this on the table, and I was like, and what exactly are we playing here? And they're like, oh, you're a pharaoh, and you're buying land, and you're trading, and you're building pyramids and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, okay, so like, so is this Ra? And they're like, no, man, this is Amun-Re. This is a board game. This is all about, like, you know, Euro mechanics. I was like, I am a fan of these Euro mechanics you're speaking of. And I like what I'm working with here. Cause again, this is back in the day where everything was a form of beige or a light form of green. And here you had a beautiful board of the Nile. And again, on the Reiner Knizia graphic design style, it was very segmented up as far as, you know, quartered up. And basically what you're trying to do is you're trying to control these different areas of the Nile in order to produce resources and goods throughout the game. What's really cool, again, and this is how far we've come, Anthony, the pyramids are awesome. These little plastic pyramids, yes, that you get to put on the table and you're like, oh, this is adorable. Like, is this a super deluxe version? This is before super deluxe versions were a thing. But back in the day, it was very cool to put these little plastic pyramids on the table. So as the game goes on, you are taking opportunities to capture these different areas. You're playing power cards. You're buying farmers. You're buying stones to put together, again, these very cool pyramids. And then you are scoring money and resources, again, in order to sacrifice the gold to Amun-Re. And then the game takes a really interesting, weird twist, because now there's going to be a second phase. And everything that you just did, especially as a Euro gamer, goes away, gets wiped out. And that's kind of nuts, because here you were playing all these auction cards throughout the game, and you control these different areas with the farmers and the pyramids. And now those great areas that you built up are now available to kind of repurchase and to build up yet again. So that was one of those games that, you know, I never experienced, right? Like, you're playing a Euro game. You're building a section up. Great idea. You built it up. Now it comes back up for play again. And again, a lot of different ways to score points, a lot of special cards that are going to give you endgame points, power cards throughout the game. It's just, again, a very nice production, straightforward, and then it washes away. Again, like the Nile does, and then you have to come back and rebuild. So, very smart, interesting game. One of my favorites, Amun-Re.
This is the best, like, pure full board game from Reiner Knizia, because it is a pure full board game. It's not even particularly abstract. No? Like, the theme really comes through in this one.
Yeah, you got.
And it's like that midway point. The first time I played it, we're like, all right, now we do it again. I'm like,
what?
I legit had that same reaction. I'm like,
what?
Wait a second.
Yeah. It's just like, no, if you, I built all the things.
If you said that when you told me the rules, I didn't catch it. So now what? Yeah. We're playing the game twice. 100%. No, we're not playing it twice. We're resetting. Like, oh, come on. So great, great game. Yeah. So number two on our list is a game that was very recently run through Kickstarter from Allplay. They got the new version up, is Through the Desert. So this is a game from 1998 originally, and it is another one of Knizia's very abstract-y games. In fact, it feels a lot like Go. So if you've never played Go, it's a game in which you are placing pieces out on a very large grid and trying to capture your opponent's pieces, right? Or basically surround them. And so similarly in this game, you have camels, and you're placing them on these hexes on the desert, and you're trying to create these kind of corrals or sections where things are getting surrounded, or you're able to connect different elements between the palm trees and the oases with your camels before someone else can, right? So it is a pure strategy game. It's all about kind of waiting to see what your opponent's doing, where they're going, how you're going to manage it. It's plays from 2 to 5 players, which is crazy. If you play with 5, it's incredibly tight. BGG recommends 3. I recommend 3. I think I've played it 4. It was fine. Mm. 5 is a little rough. Don't recommend it personally. It was rough. There's like, you just run out of spots and people get stuck. No one's even trying to take it. You're just like, and I go here. Like, why? Why did you go there? And it's not my turn for like another 15 minutes now. But if you like really abstract games with like an interesting theme laid on top of them, there's a new, again, pretty version that just was released from Allplay. I have the like the Z-Man edition that was released, like the Euro Classics one, maybe 5-10 years ago, and which is pretty similar and looks very nice. It's a great game. Through the Desert, one of my favorite abstracts of his.
Very nice. Well, that leads us to our number one, Reiner Knizia games. Lots of great games here. Hard to select just one, especially amongst the 700 plus. But if it's going to be any game, it's going to be a game that we feel redefines gaming or has like a Hall of Fame status in a particular mechanic or function. It's going to be Raw, man. It's Raw. Raw is an auction game, very kind of loosely built upon the Egyptian theme. You're playing over the Egyptian civilization, 1500 plus years, and you are playing over three different epochs, three different ages here. And basically what it comes down to is you are going to have an opportunity to bid for tiles as they become available on the board. Now, again, seems very simple, very straightforward, but this is where things become very challenging because you are only going to have these sun tokens that have numbers on them. So everyone at the start of the game, you get these sun tokens, and these are your bidding numbers. So there are a lot of different opportunities for set collection, for running certain numbers, some score every round, some score at the end of the game. So all of these different tiles that come out have different abilities that typically do benefit you, but almost always they benefit you if you have a set or a collection of them. So as the game goes on, you're kind of pressing your luck as these different tiles come out, and then you decide at some point you're going to call Ra. And you pull out the giant rod, you slam it down the table, it starts the auction, and now at this point, people are using their sun tiles to be able to win that selection of tiles. Now, not only do you win the selection of tiles if you win, or if you win, depending on what you win on that time, but you also win the number, that sun tile. So later on, that becomes part of your scoring. And later, for a tile for play throughout the game. So pull out tiles from the bag. Hopefully, it doesn't call Ra for you. Hopefully, bad stuff doesn't come out. Start the bidding yourself. Play your god tiles as much as you can to kind of alter things up a little bit. And then do your bidding. Do it over three epochs, and the game comes to an end. What I really love about this game, and for me, why it's my number one game, is because coming into this game, I did not like auction games. I had played a lot of them. I did not enjoy them. And I was not looking forward to this very thin, streamlined, non-somewhat thematic game. And I loved it. And somehow my brain took to it. And I've enjoyed it ever since. I played the Super Deluxe recent version. It was awesome. Not necessary, but awesome. And yeah, it's just a fantastic game. Raw
is amazing. I'm not even a huge auction fan of any kind, really. And this is the one where I went out and spent a bunch of money on a big fancy version. So
I think it's arguably the definitive auction game.
Yeah, I would say that.
All right, everyone, there you have it. Reiner Knizia's top 10 games. Not of all time, because by the time this episode's over, he probably produced another 700 games. So at the time of this recording, this was his top 10 games. You know, by the time you listen to this, he's probably got another billion games out there. Please check these out. You will enjoy them. Like we said, a lot of these games were games that we were not interested in, did not like the mechanics. and then upon playing them, fell in love with them. And if not this 10, I don't know, 700 other ones that are out there, you'll enjoy and you will find some greatness out there in the Ryan Akinetsu collection. So until next time, this is Chris.
And this is Anthony.
And we'll save you all a seat at the table. Take care, everyone.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.